Yeah, and I hope this will be, my main goal of the talk is to launch discussion. So I'm happy if you all do most of the talking during this presentation rather than me. And hopefully this will also generate discussions as the week goes on. I'll be here through the end of the day on Friday. And I've watched most of the talks from the conference and the ones that recorded last week too. So I'll kind of try to take off from there rather than going back to the beginning. Well, just kind of a few words, an overview before I start. I think there's been lots of stuff going on in this field recently, lots of surprises to me. And I think it's very exciting. There's very big effects that hadn't been realized previously that really allow completely new ways of manipulating magnetism and spins. I'll pretty much focus entirely on metal spintronics, so I won't have much to say about semiconductors or some of the optical effects in B-centers and something like that. But even in metal spintronics, things like the spin hall effect, voltage-controlled magnetotronics, VMI, spin trampling are all huge effects that we weren't paying attention to the way we should have, say, 5 or 6 years ago. And there's even more effects that might be classified along those lines. So there's lots to do. There's lots that I'm doing in my own group, or lots going on at Cornell that I'll try to fill you in on. But these are some of the things in terms of discussion throughout the week that I'm happy to talk about. And if you have new results in these areas, please let me know, because my NSF proposal is due in 2 or 3 weeks, and that's the next thing I'll be doing. In terms of what I'm planning to talk about, you've heard quite a bit about current-induced torques related to spin-orbit coupling, but I have a bit more to say about that, so that's where I wanted to start. I'll talk a little bit about applications, but that's probably not what most of the theorists want about, so I probably won't spend a whole lot of time about that, but particularly the spin hall torque is allowing us to do lots of new kinds of devices that we think will be useful. You've heard about this project already a little bit from Nitin Samarth a couple weeks ago. Experiments are doing to try and see if we can get strong current-induced torques from topological insulators. And Yaroslav asked me to go into that in some detail, so I will focus on that. And then if there's time, and there probably won't, there's also work in my group going on in terms of following up on the Ungerth group's work on anti-fermionic spintronics and trying to use atomic membrane materials like graphene as tunnel barriers. And I probably won't have time to talk about those, but if you want to ask me about those later on in the week, we can certainly do that. So the first thing I do want to focus on is the spin hall effect. The main purpose of this slide is just to give credit to all the people who worked on this subject before I knew anything about it. But I will just also define the spin hall ratio is the ratio of the spin current density that's produced by the spin hall effect relative to the charge current density. So that's one of the figure of merits that we'll be focusing on. Why is this interesting? Well, different groups have different motivations for studying spin hall effect. Some people are mostly interested as sort of spin current detectors. We're mostly interested in it as a spin current source, with the idea being that it seems that this is gives you the ability to do a much more efficient current-induced generation of torques than what's been done previously through spin filtering through many multilayers. If you just have spin filtering physics, the most efficient spin torque you can get corresponds to the transfer of 1 unit of h-bar/2 per unit charge in your current. And the most that's actually been demonstrated is about 0.7 h-bar/2. But what the spin hall effect gives you is a chance to overcome that limit to get efficiencies of torque that correspond to many units of h-bar/2 per unit charge in the electron. And the way you can see how that comes about is thinking about these sort of simple bilayer devices, where you think about some heavy metal, spin hall metal, and some ferromagnet up here. What the spin hall effect does is there's a sort of in-plane current flowing through the heavy metal. It generates a vertically flowing spin current that can be absorbed by the ferromagnet and apply a torque. If you want to think about how strong that torque is, the torque is just given by the amount of spin current, not the spin current density, that's absorbed by the ferromagnet. And so if looking down the ferromagnet, you have some large area, big A up here, that's just the spin current density times the area, big A. While the current you apply is the charge current density in the plane times a smaller area, A here, if you have a thin film. So the idea is if the efficiency of the torque is given not by the spin hall angle by itself, but by a spin hall angle times the geometric ratio of these areas. And the area, the lateral area A can be much bigger than the in-plane area A if you have a thin film. So with sort of typical device parameters, say making a 50-nanometer device with a 2-nanometer thickness, which you can do because that's really just limited by Well, there's a length scale over which you need to have the spin Hall effect develop. In a bulk theory, it's the spin diffusion length. With the numbers we get, yes, please.
Sorry for the interruption. May I ask a question? But this scaling with the areas, this is just a trivial renormalization. So it's, if you would define it by current densities, you wouldn't have the area included on. It's
right.
Not really that you can enhance the effect with the area on.
Well, what matters from applications is how much torque you can get per current that goes through the device. Because it turns out that the limiting thing on making these devices smaller and making them attractive from a production standpoint is how much current you have. Because the amount of current you need determines how large a transistor you need to have, and that determines the total area of the structure. So
then you also have to switch a larger magnetization if you make the area larger. So I wonder whether you're gaining a lot.
Well, what you need is to have the area doesn't matter so much, it's the anisotropy that matters. You want to have a thermally stable magnetic device.
The total magnetic momentum, which scales with the area, right?
What you need to have scale is you need to pick your materials and your geometry so that you have a thermal barrier to activation, to flipping your magnetization about, of about 40 or 60 kT or something like that.
Yes, but that involves the total magnetization and also the area.
It does, but if you scale your area with your materials properties, so you always have about 40 kBT, it's really the total amount of torque you can apply that matters.
Maybe, but I'm not sure what is the total torque you need to flip that magnetization. It is, if it's, for example, not a spin hole, but you do like some damping effect we were discussing earlier, it would be the same ratio if you would actually have the same gain.
I think the point is that sort of these in-plane processes are more efficient than the spin filtering process.
Yeah, okay, that's no doubt. Yeah, that we agree. That's actually.
Does it make sense also to introduce dissipated energy per unit of torque produced?
So that's another thing that's important for applications. If you had no problem with current, that you had as small a transistor as you wanted, and you can get as much current from that, then the next thing you would want is to make the energy as small as possible, to have the energy cost.
But the energy would scale also with the area. If you make your device longer, then the dissipated energy will also scale.
Right. Mm-hmm. But at least from talking to the people in companies, they say the first thing they need to solve is get the current down, and then if the current comes down, then they want to worry about the energy. That's kind of the way they talk. So this gets, yes, please.
The reason that this spin hole is much efficient is because it reuses the spins.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I gave a little cartoon here. Essentially, one electron goes through, transfers the electron, sort of diffuses back, gets repolarized, and so the process can repeat many times.
So you can sort of increase your efficiency by making a little smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. Surely there's a limit to that.
Right. So experimentally, you can do that experiment and do various thicknesses. What we find is, say, for platinum, you need about a critical length scale of about 1.5 nanometers, where it seems to fit a bulk spin diffusion theory. With tantalum and tungsten, the other materials that have very strong effects, it seems to be about the same. If you use materials with larger spin diffusion lengths, you'd need larger thicknesses. And so I'll come to this, but one of the things you need for this kind of application is a short spin diffusion length to have high efficiencies. That's opposite if you want a spin detector, but spin sources, spin detectors, you'll probably want to use different materials for those.
What was the response for with interaction and interface? Maybe engineered in some other way.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, we have a bulk theory to try to rationalize some of these things. Whether that's actually the true microscopic theory is something we can certainly discuss. Let me comment on the first, and then you can comment on them. So the main purpose of the talk here is just to sort of define terms. I don't want to talk about mechanisms quite yet. I want to talk about the experiments first, And here, in terms of here, I just want to use these terms to talk about the directions of the torques that we measure. And so if you just have purely a spin Hall torque, what that corresponds to is a torque in a definite direction. Say, I'm having pictures here where I have one of these bilayers, the current is flowing this way, we're lurking edge on. Within the spin Hall picture, you just have an effective spin torque pointing in one direction, which means if you want to think about it in terms of equivalent magnetic fields, they actually rotate around this way.
Okay.
Versus a Rochebot or Oersted type picture where you would have a field in one direction and the torques would be move around. But with this sort of system, you can just sort of, if you measure a component one way or the other, I'll just sort of use those names to find the directions of those components. This is not completely general, which is maybe the point you want to make.
I would actually even press you a little bit now to think of a nomenclature because, you know, by putting those labels, I mean, I understand perfectly, and I agreed a year ago that would be the labels I would have chosen totally. Mm-hmm. But now that we know better, just to do a spin hole for the anti-damping one or the dissipative torque and the Rochebot, which is really the inverse galvanic effect torque, I think we would be better off calling them by their symmetry names, not because by putting spin Hall, you're already labeling that microscopic, you know, in the subconscious. I mean, that the problem is that, okay, if it is spin Hall, you know, which is by experiments to determine, if at the moment all you're measuring is a symmetry, which is valid, I mean, from the point of view of experiments, it doesn't matter really what it is at the end, but it may prevent us from understanding more the microscopics later on to make it even better. I guess as Jasmine was saying, that, you know, it may be an interface, more interface focus, which could allow for better engineering. So from that point of view, from the purpose of this talk, I agree, don't change anything, but I think in the future, we may want to think of...
I think that's a perfectly fair comment. I guess I would say from an experiment point of view, I haven't seen anything yet that convinces me that the microscopic picture is different than this. So I certainly have seen models where you could imagine other things could happen. I haven't seen experiments which show those effects are important relative to the samples we've seen so far.
In the bilayer metals, or we've shown the experiment that shows the anti-damping.
In the gallium-manganese arsenide, I think the different system. I was thinking about the metal system.
Okay.
But phenologically, you know, I also agree with Harold. I don't think you should really get into microscopics already at the level of nomenclature. The nomenclature should be neutral. And then it's the next question about the microscope. I think something like thin-like and damping-like would be generic.
I totally
agree that at the moment, from the experiment point of view, there's nothing that can distinguish on those experiments that I've seen either.
Mm-hmm.
But nor can it distinguish the other way around.
Okay.
I mean, I think is that, you know, just as I mentioned in my talk, was about momentum. At the beginning, okay, that's all you knew.
Mm.
That's all the intuition we have. Now that we know that those two possibilities exist, you're already biased in one thing versus the other. That's the thing that I would like to be careful. For example, when Nitin gave his talk, and he said very happily a whole angle of four,
well,
that's the hot triangle.
Yeah, that's not a nomenclature I use.
Yeah, that's actually a long problem in principle. Because
it's not a label, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the expert, it's not a problem. For the people outside the community, it wouldn't be a problem.
If you have an angle 230 degrees, that's fine.
I mean, people use that.
That's fine.
No.
That's a little bit funny.
For example, the ordinary Hall effect, people define sigma xy over sigma xx as a whole angle, and it's infinite.
Yeah.
For quantum Hall. And it's not, there's no problem. And spin Hall, you know, by principle, it's a perfectly fine nomenclature. As long as you don't think any further.
Right.
If you apply charge current like this, you measure torque.
That's fine.
Then, in principle, it's okay, as long as you think of it
broadly. By putting that label, you are labeling the microscopics.
There's one physical distinction that's more important. The name is, you touched on it, it's whether it's an anti-damping torque or not an anti-damping torque.
I think that's the
And these symmetries, the Rochebot effect would not be allowed anti-damping, the spin Hall effect could, depending on exactly what the angles of all the magnets are. And that's important for applications. If you're trying to make a transition without anti-damping, you generally need a torque that's proportional to the anisotropy field, which is generally a big torque.
Going back to say that they're not allowed or not, I mean, when you say the Rochebot symmetry,
what is
the symmetry? No, you're saying,
If I say the rush path,
I'm saying if you have, if it's just an effective field that points in a particular direction.
Yeah, but this is much more specific than the rush path symmetry.
It's like an Oersted symmetry.
Okay, so, perfect. Yeah. I mean, if it's just the label of the symmetry, that's perfectly correct. But typically, people say rush path symmetry, you only mean that you break mirror symmetry by the interface, and that allows for both topics.
But they're not saying rush path symmetry, they're saying rush path effect.
Maybe Oersted symmetry from an experimental point of view, it'd be like an Oersted field. In this geometry.
Yeah,
And if you have an anti-damping, you can you need a torque that's generally proportional to the damping times the mass active field, which is 100 times lower. So in terms of most applications, not necessarily all, you want the anti-damping is the one to focus on first. So that's why we pay that more attention. Okay, so the first thing I want to talk about briefly, not in too much detail, is just what's the status of trying to measure the spin Hall effect and the spin Hall angle. I'll divide this into a few different classes of techniques. One class of techniques tries to measure torques. So you put a current in, you try to measure the torque that's on the magnetization nearby. And you can do this a number of ways. And I think there were some beginning issues in this field where people were learning about techniques and artifacts and stuff like that. But I think things are converging in terms of this class of measurement technique. Now that people are finding numbers for the anti-damping component of the torques that that seems to agree for the different materials. So just in terms of running down these things, the first technique for doing this, and one I think is still one of the most reliable from Saito's group, is to do some sort of magnetic resonance measurement, measure the line width, see how the line width changes due to anti-damping as you pass in-plane current. And from those kinds of slopes, you can get out a spin Hall angle. We have some differences with the first paper, just about exactly what the translation is. But the idea, I think, is perfectly valid. And we don't know of any artifacts that get in the way of this. If you have enough signals and noise to measure this, you get the right answer from this technique.
But basically, this by the reduction or increase of the line width, you infer the effective damping.
And in homogeneous broadening, when you put the transition metal on top of the ferromagnet, some inhomogeneous broadening.
So you need the homogeneous part. You just want the slope.
So you look at the frequency dependence.
Yeah, you look at the frequency dependence. Well, if the inhomogeneous.
Since if it's done in the cavity, it's not that simple to.
Yeah, if inhomogeneous broadening doesn't depend on the current, then you don't need to worry about these things, but you would want to worry if it depended on the current.
Okay. Well, in single cavity, you do field dependence. Same thing.
So the other technique that we think is very good is just sort of tilting measurements. Where you there's various ways you can measure sort of the tilting of the angle, either in plane or perpendicular to the plane. You pass a current, you can see how the spin Hall torque tilts things, and those measurements work well too. This was actually first used to try to measure an effective field torque by Pi et al., but it's been used for both components now. There are some experiments with different numbers, but they seem to be ones that have very small perpendicular anisotropy fields, which makes me think there might be some non-uniform magnetic dynamics going on. And it's also a bit prone to heating effects, so you have to be careful about heating. The idea being if you heat the sample up, you can change the demagnetization field and you get a tilting from that as well. But except for those two artifacts, which you can be careful about experimentally, this also seems to give the same numbers, and it's a fairly simple experimental measurement. The technique that we've used a lot is rather than just a non-resonant tilting, essentially it's a resonant tilting experiment where you apply an AC current near the resonance frequency and detect the magnetic resonance response. And you get different line shapes depending on how strong an Oersted-like torque versus a spin Hall-like torque you have. So from analyzing the symmetric and asymmetric parts of the signal, you can get out the two components of torque that way. And this works well. I think it's the technique that has the largest signal to noise if you're trying to measure weak effects. But the effects we're measuring now are strong, and all the other methods are pretty much fine for the strongest materials. This does have some artifacts that we've learned about since we published the first paper about it. In the first paper, we assumed that the only torque with Oersted symmetry that was there was the true Oersted field. And I think that's probably just fine for the rather thick ferromagnetic samples we were studying back then. But you don't want to assume that in general. We did that mostly just so we have a nice way of calibrating the current density in the normal metal. If you know what the Oersted field is, you know what the current density in the normal metal is, and then you can use that to try to define what the spin Hall angle is. But you can work out what the current density in normal metal is just by usual techniques of what's the microwave impedance of your sample and the resistivities and things with nearly as good an accuracy. And so you don't need to assume this for the technique, and in general, we don't assume that anymore. The other artifact that can come in is if the spin pumping signal. You get a signal that has a symmetric resonance line shape from spin pumping plus the inverse spin Hall effect in these materials, like has been measured by the argon group and cycle group as well. And so that can be a technique that can come in and change your numbers. What we found experimentally is that becomes important when you have very thin ferromagnets and when the spin Hall metal has a low resistivity compared to the ferromagnet. That's just those are two things determine how much the symmetric signal due to the spin Hall effect, how big that is relative to the symmetric signal due to the spin pumping plus the inverse spin Hall effect.
Is the explanation why the low resistivity compared to for impedance matching?
So that the biggest effect there is how it affects the effect of spin mixing conductance. I think this can explain why some other groups are getting somewhat different results. Otani group did an experiment where they measured over a much wider range of ferromagnetic thicknesses than what we measured and found for very thin ferromagnets they got effectively a smaller spin Hall angle. I think that's because they were seeing a spin pumping contribution that comes in with the opposite sign and gives you a smaller symmetric signal.
So it cancels part of the anti-dumping, I guess.
I don't think it cancels. I think you just have two symmetric terms that can have relative amplitudes, and so you're not measuring what you think you're measuring. Otani tried to think about the intrinsic spin Hall angles by extrapolating to zero ferromagnetic thickness and got a different number than we are. If you actually extrapolate to thick ferromagnetic thicknesses with his numbers, you get about the same numbers we do. So I think that's what it is. So we're trying to be very quantitative about the spin puppy now and write something up about that, but we're not quite done with that. But it does seem to come in with an opposite sign and make things look like you have too small spin Hall angle or the opposite sign. It can actually reverse things if you're not careful. So you do have to be careful with the technique, which is why we always try to check it against techniques with different kinds of artifacts or fewer artifacts at these days. And then the other ways you can measure the spin Hall angle is the rubber hit the road kind of techniques. If you're really trying to measure spin Hall switching or current-induced domain wall motion, you can get out the strength of torque from the currents or the equivalent fields and these kinds of things too. And those numbers are seeming to agree now. This is what we care about most in terms of factor applications. And so those are the measurements that really matter to us. So there are other techniques that are used to try to measure the spin Hall angle or the spin Hall ratio as well. Some of these techniques are actually done, both ones I talked about were done before the torque techniques. And I think it's an interesting question whether these techniques get the same answer and whether they should get the same answer. The one I'll talk about first is the sort of technique pioneered by the Saito group and then sort of made much more quantitative by the argon group of doing a spin pumping experiment, sort of making the magnet in the bilayer process, having that inject a spin current into the platinum, and then having inverse spin Hall effect give you a voltage that comes out. When this was originally done, they got a very small number for the spin Hall angle in platinum. They made various corrections over time, so as of 2010, they were still having a number five or six times smaller than what we had. But I think there's a fairly simple explanation for that. Essentially, when the spin pumping happens, the spin gets injected from the ferromagnet into the normal metal, and over some length scale, the spin current is converted to a charge current. So I'll call that length scale lambda. In a bulk theory, it would be the spin diffusion length. But the number you get out for the spin Hall angle depends on what number you use for that spin diffusion length, because how much overall charge current you generate flowing in the normal metal layer is bigger if you have a longer spin diffusion length, so you get a larger signal. So you have to know what the spin diffusion length is to work out from what you measure to determine what the spin Hall angle is.
I have a question to that. So the way you define spin Hall angle, let's take the same structure and do this to experiments on the same structure. Let's not worry about spin diffusion lengths. I don't know what spin diffusion length is. Right. So I have 10 nanometers of platinum over there and 2 nanometers of permalloy, let's say. You send charge current, you measure torque, right? That's the first experiment. Then here, I really understand why spin diffusion becomes an issue, because all you have to do by Bayes' reciprocity is to measure voltage induced by magnetic dynamics, and that's your spin Hall angle, according to your definition, just experimentally, without without mentioning spin mixing conductance, spin diffusion length. So I don't understand why somehow all of a sudden we have to switch to this intricate theoretical analysis rather than just measuring voltage and extracting
this is
spin Hall angle directly as an Onsager reciprocal quantity.
This is a question I have too. I'm not sure how really to apply Onsager in these situations.
Well, it's very easy.
This is a discussion.
Basically, because of I can show it directly by Onsager reciprocity. So if you have a structure bilayer, so for a magnet, a normal metal, everything is fixed. I'm not going to be changing thickness. I'm going to make experiment on the same structure. The way Onsager reciprocity works out is as follows. In one case, you're applying a voltage and you're measuring torque on the magnetic order parameter. Mm-hmm. In the other, you excite dynamics. So if the torque, if you write torque, now let me define torque as a spin Hall angle. Okay, let me drop the vectorial factors times voltage, right? Forget about the vectors and all that. Some geometrical factor. Then the current, Bayes' reciprocity, is going to be the same quantity times magnetic dynamics. With some kind of Z, some other factors times Z, something like that. And so the way you define spin Hall angle, you're actually thinking of voltage as current density divided by, forget about the length, as conductivity. So conductivity will creep into this formula. So the way, actually, if you define this, it's going to hold angle through J.
I don't mind measuring voltages. I mean,
which is sigma times V. And basically, sigma will kick in here. But the point is that if you know what the conductivity is, just ordinary ohmic conductivity, and you perform this to measurements, that should give you the same quantity irrespective of microscopic details.
So I guess a question, I didn't know how to think about the spin pumping in terms of the kind of gradient that you normally have in an Onsager relationship. For the driving force.
That's it. And you have to average it, or you have to know which mode you excite, some kind of elliptical mode, you have to average it, but that's kind of standard that you can figure out. So in that sense, it's going to be, of course, the current, your average is going to be proportional to power, but that kind of analysis, I think people can do quite unambiguously. Okay. So somehow, I'm really confused once you start going to some microscopics, because already at the level of phenomenology, there should be very direct connection irrespective of the microscopics.
So I don't think that kind of analysis, anybody's tried that. And I want to try to...
You measure, right? You measure, you excite, you send some microwave, and you measure the voltage, right? If
but
you know which mode...
If you're not in the same setup
as you could. You could measure the same sample. I mean, that wouldn't be too hard to do.
So and then you know which mode you're exciting. I mean, it's very standard FMR problem. You could calculate, once you measure JC, you can calculate any non-conductivity. Without any other input, you could calculate back the spin Hall angle, which should, by Onsager reciprocity, agree with what you measured first. And if it doesn't agree, then we're clearly missing something much more important than just...
Okay, well, one of my goals would be to understand this before I leave this week.
Okay,
so
let me
record it.
Even on the same sample, you use FMR to excite some mode. It doesn't have to be the same mode that you use in
they're not relying on any mode. Of course, to calculate, you have to know what mode you're exciting.
Yeah, but if your FMR excited mode is not the same mode as
your FMR, that's not relevant. Relevant is how much entropy you're introducing in the system, how much drive you have. So if you know that magnitude, you can match it.
We need to know which mode you're exciting. Of course, otherwise you cannot do any analysis.
So the torque is probably acting on some other modes.
problem. In the existing films, I think people know, understand FMR very well. I mean, there should be no mystery about FMR.
Yeah, but
right? And
how they talk, actually, on they probably
does
preference on some models. On
this is, look, I mean, this is really a perturbation in practice as far as FMR goes. We can probably, to a good approximation, for starters, just work out FMR as is, and then plug it in. There are some higher order effects, which are quadratic in spin hole angle. We can worry about those later.
Why don't we do it in some Mm-hmm. Why don't we have a discussion dedicated specifically to that?
Okay, but we can get back to it. I'm, you know, this is the kind of what this is what I wanted to get out of this conference too. So, but I think just in terms of the story, if you have a picture where you're starting with some spin current injecting into a heavy metal and trying to figure out how much voltage it applies, all the effects of shunting and things like that come in, and you need to know these parameters. And but I guess the bottom of the day, what Axel reported a week and a half ago, is if you actually measure the signals you get as a function of the thickness of the spin hall metal layer, you get a length scale much better agreement with what we've seen in the direct torque experiments. And if you plug that number in, you're getting much closer to the measurements we've seen. So I don't think in platinum there's disagreements between the methods now, though there's still a bit more to do to see exactly how quantitative the agreement is. But another thing Hass reported is if he tries to do the same things for tantalum, he's seeing a spin hall angle effectively less than 1%, which is a big difference from what we see about 13 or 15%. And I sent an Axel email yesterday asking a bit more about what the analysis is, and I haven't heard back from him yet. But I expect what's going on here is that tantalum and platinum are different a lot in their resistivity by about a factor of 10. And if you think about the physics of the effect of spin mixing conductance, then you expect big differences simply from that effect. That platinum is a very good spin absorber, but tantalum is terrible. If you try to inject spin in tantalum, it runs away and heads back to the ferromagnet and just never gets there because of the effect of spin mixing conductance. So if you think about the bare mixing conductance, you have to figure out what fraction of the spin current that you try to inject goes into the heavy metal versus what fraction goes back to the ferromagnet. And this fraction is very small for tantalum, where it's reasonably large for platinum. So I expect that's why he's seeing small signals, but I don't know if his analysis had taken sort of this correction into account yet or not. So if I hear back from Axel, I'll let you know about that. But that's my first guess about what's going on in terms of that difference. The simple sort of effect of spin mixing inductance probably hasn't been taken into account yet, but we'll see about that. But the bottom line is for the techniques, you do need to know parameters. You need to have separate measurements of the effect of mixing inductance and whatever this length scale is to know what the spin hall angle is. And one of the problems with this field is that people were guessing about some of those parameters early on and getting bad numbers out because of those guesses. But it seems now that they're actually making real measurements, the numbers are starting to agree, at least between this technique and the torque technique. A bit more problematic. Oh, one thing I want to mention is in thinking about sort of just in terms of preparing this talk, I realized that probably the torque techniques aren't really measuring the intrinsic spin hall conductivity within the heavy metal. I think we're doing correctly measuring how much torque you get in the ferromagnet for how much current flows inside the heavy metal. But if you think there really is a microscopic spin hall angle within the bulk heavy metal, probably you need to do a backflow correction for our experiments as well. You need to think about there's some fraction of spin that gets from the heavy metal into the ferromagnet, and using the same logic people use for spin pumping, in our case, that would be the bare mixing conductance divided by that ratio. So this is what fraction goes into the ferromagnet rather than flows back into the spin
hall. Yeah, mixing conductance for very heavy metal where spin ups and spin down are not well defined. Is it just for you, does the effective measurement of transmittance then, or what?
So at least my understanding of the spin diffusion theory of things is that you just use the regular electrical conductivity here.
No, what I'm saying is, like, in this case, it's very heavy metals. You know, mm-hmm. The spin charge diffusion equations don't work. So you may want to believe that they do, but
basically, don't. I think we should not do this. I mean, you have a nice experiment and you're tracing back to try to extract some quantity which is theoretically defined.
Yeah, so the only reason to do this is you're trying to make some comparison with ab initio calculations about what the spin hall angle would be inside.
It's all juggling with some physical quantities.
Okay. But you suggest that in tantalum, the spin can have some backflow, so that means...
No, in this case, it would be the platinum where there'd be backflow. The tantalum and the tungsten are high enough resistivity or low enough conductivity, you can ignore this term.
Okay.
I also don't understand here why you don't have the transmission through the interface here. You only have mixing and resistivity of
this would be the fraction that the goal here, and I'm not sure this is right. I put this up here so I could ask Yaroslav and Garrett and the rest of you whether you should do something like this. This would be the transmission coefficient of getting from.
Okay. Let's have the initial people do calculate talks. That would be much better.
Okay. I'd be happy with that.
Let's calculate spin hall angle
What
the unit group did, actually, the calculation that I showed, the unit group, they calculated the torques of the five layers. That's it.
Yeah, I think that's how we should.
That's actually what they obtained, and that's actually a Howard brush effect.
Okay.
So in reality, that's what you're getting.
So this is Ebert and those folks, or
no? This is the Stefan Blue.
Okay.
They have a different interpretation that is not quite correct. I'll explain to you why. But in reality, the calculation was similar. Hours is really torque that they calculated. I agree with you, but they didn't do it that long.
But in that calculation, they assumed the form of torque and the.
No, they didn't. They just calculated torque. I mean, they assume that it's coming from an non-equilibrium polarization. That's it. That's exactly what we did.
Yeah. So many ways.
You
could calculate the torque directly. You could use Onzaga and calculate pumping. There are many tricks there. But then they come with these unambiguous, experimental unambiguous.
So the nice thing is that they can actually turn on and off the spin orbit in the platinum layer by layer. And this is one way how to distinguish between the really interface effect and maybe something.
They didn't do that just yet, but
that's something they can
do.
But the tokens they use, this is for the coherent conductance. It's defined from a coherent current.
By coherent current.
Yeah, but it's not in the diffusive limit.
No. This is just
a conductor
bilayer system, a finite bilayer system. There was actually
a
bit of an issue with that.
It's
a co-formalism in the bilayer system.
In co-formalism, you have to define a form of torque and then do
But it's defined through the non-equilibrium polarization that you induce.
Form of torque and then do the calculation.
But I disagree with that. You don't assume that, you just calculate the non-equilibrium polarization as a function of the magnetization direction. And that's to give you the symmetries. That's how it comes out.
But that was on the right hand side of the MVT. And as long as you have all defined quantity,
there's no predefinition there. You're going to only have to turn that dump it and dump it. That's it. You're going to have to break them apart here. And then the interpretation was okay. There's a different issues of how to interpret it, but we can go over that.
I'd love to. Yeah.
Thank you. This is really important.
Okay. The other class of measurements that's been attempted to do things like measure the spin angle is the lateral spin diffusion experiments that are mostly done by Otani group. And this was actually the first measurement to try to measure the spin angle in platinum. They got an extremely small angle, less than 1%. About a factor of 20 or 25 smaller than what we think is the correct answer. This was a beautiful experiment. I was jealous, and I'm still jealous. They measured both the direct and the inverse spin Hall effect in the same sample. They showed all the Onzag relationships work. But the numbers aren't right, and we understand why the numbers aren't right. And they're not right in a way that makes the whole technique somewhat difficult in terms of getting quantitative answers out. So you can think about the issues from the inverse spin Hall effect or the direct spin Hall effect. But in terms of the direct spin Hall effect, what they did in their analysis is the idea was to put a charge current through a thin platinum layer, drive spins into a copper layer, and then do a magnetic resistance measurement to measure the spin accumulation in the copper. The problem in the original analysis was they assumed that when they applied the charge current, it flowed only within the platinum and didn't flow into the copper. But in reality, the copper has resistivity that's a lot lower than platinum. The charge current is going to do something like this, and the charge current in the platinum is a whole lot less than what was originally assumed in the analysis. So there's a shunting effect. The charge current goes this way. And so because they assume there's a whole lot more charge current than there was, they ended up getting a much smaller spin Hall angle than they should have. So we point this out to them, and we've had ongoing discussions about trying to figure out what's the best way of correcting for this sort of shunting. So they've tried a couple of different things. One was to do kind of a one-dimensional model assuming that the charge current density in the platinum is uniform through the thickness of the platinum, and then they give a correction factor, just what fraction of the current flows in the copper versus the platinum, and with that correction factor, the spin angle comes up somewhat, but not as much as what we measure. And I think the issue there is that the correction for shunting really is surprisingly subtle. If you actually calculate what the current density is, the current density is not uniform in the platinum. Basically, if you think about the binding conditions, the transverse electric field has to be continuous across the barrier. And if it's because of the difference in the conductivities, that means that the current density in the platinum right near the interface is a whole lot less than the copper, and then the current density grows slightly as you go down toward the bottom part of the platinum. You just do a proper sort of 3D finite element calculation. So that's one problem. But then the issue is that all the different parts of the thickness of the platinum don't contribute equally in terms of the spin Hall effect either. You really just have only the part of the platinum near the interface within a spin diffusion length or within whatever this length scale is really contribute. And so for these sorts of systems where if you have a high resistivity material, you really underestimate that you have a whole lot less current density here than what you assume from a uniform kind of thing. So the one-dimensional approximation trying to correct the shunting gives problematic answers too. So the Ohtani group has a series of papers with different approximations, different ways of doing the shunting. They get different numbers out for the spin Hall angle. And I think if you want to do this correctly, you really need a sort of a new 3D modeling of all the current structure. And they've started to do that, but even that's somewhat difficult because it depends on the transparency of the interface, which is difficult to know experimentally. So I think this technique is good for screening, what effects have big effects versus not. But if you're trying to be quantitative, I don't think this effect really gives quantitative answers. It's a beautiful experiment, and it's sort of unfortunate, I think, that it doesn't give quantitative answers. But I don't trust the numbers from these sorts of measurements. So I saw a couple of presentations during the seminar where people tried to agglomerate the data from all different techniques and try to learn something from that. I think that's a very dangerous thing to do because most of the numbers in this field are wrong. people are working on correcting them over time. And so, including some of
them. I don't think there's a terrible algorithm scale. This one is the
standard. It's usually double.
So generally, I think the best thing to do is do two or more techniques and see if you get the same answer and you get some trustworthiness that way.
That, for example, in this method, there are some difficult to measure the interface event.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the spin Hall example, there are some backflow and the spin pumping contribution problem. It may be very difficult to quantify everything.
So I think if you want to quantify torques per unit current, you can do that. You get whatever goes to the interface. You don't need to try to understand that microscopically. If you deal with those measurable quantities, you can get trustworthy numbers. I think this is the point that Yaroslav was making. I think if you try to work through the simple theories, comparing the spin pumping plus inverse spin Hall effect measurements to the spin torque measurements, it looks to me like if you're careful within the simple theory that those numbers should basically be the same. So I think that's where things stand right now. It remains to be seen. People are still working on more experiments. Certainly, our group needs to do more materials and more thickness dependencies and stuff like that. That's all in the works. But that's sort of the way it looks like things are heading toward me. Okay. So in terms of the numbers sort of from our own group, the ones that I trust that we've measured by multiple techniques, this is what we get for the platinum, the high resistivity form of tantalum, and the high resistivity form of tungsten. The other large number is from the Ohtani group of bismuth-doped copper. That's certainly a large number. I'm not sure what the error bars on that measurement are.
Mm-hmm. If in those are the always by layer samples, right? Mm-hmm. So if and they are measuring that through torques.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was another contribution to this, so would you label this as an effective spin Hall angle of in the relationship between the current and the torque? Or, microscopically, you're talking about a spin Hall angle, and then you make a lot of noise and say, okay, this is matching the intrinsic calculation of the ball.
It doesn't match the intrinsic calculation.
Or the tantalum is 0.15 versus 0.2.
No, it's way off.
It's way off.
Uh-huh.
the sign.
The sign, the signs, I mean, when I talk about the Tanaka calculation, I want to give them credit for suggesting where we look. But the except for the sign, the numbers, I'll have a slide about that.
This one is larger, for example.
I'll show you, let's see, where do I have that? Yeah, here's that. So they express things in terms of spin Hall conductivity, assuming it's an intrinsic effect. So if we multiply the values we get times the electrical conductivity measure, this is the numbers we get.
What I'm saying is that, okay, if you have two microscopic origins that is giving you same symmetries, mm-hmm. that you could have a mixture of the two.
Sure.
In there, I would call that an effective measure of, I wouldn't take it to be
positive whatsoever.
I would agree with you.
These are all torques.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, no, that's the point. Mm-hmm.
And this is only the.
When it comes to less for a target for us, that's the thing that is difficult. This is the sales I was saying. If bulk calculations versus real, now we have to go to the specific structure of the measurement, which is going to be the challenge. But we have to be very careful about the differentiation of those two.
And this is only the component that has the spin Hall symmetry, too. I'll talk about the other component here shortly.
But your statement is, in general, that all the measured values are never really related to bike values that calculated. For example, ab initio calculations. So these processes, all the processes you are talking about, and even the process in the measurement of Otani's group, is related to the interface, and it's an interface.
In these current structures and setups?
I think as experimenters, I wouldn't say anything about that question. I don't think we know methods. I don't think we know interface versus bulk so much. I think there's things we can do to try to separate those things, and I'll talk about that too. But by and large, those experiments really haven't been finished yet.
So you mean a real thickness dependence, and then you can separate an interface contribution?
Or having different kinds of spacers in between the ferromagnet and heavy metal, those kinds of experiments.
I suppose the interface itself, and it's probably different layers to anneal it or something.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, certainly how much intermixing you have would probably be a very big, and that's not something we know too much about yet.
Sputtering versus epitaxial versus various things.
I mean, it's hard to know what exactly goes on with a nanometer.
So
that was
the main effect, the numbers.
Yes. Just if you try to think about comparing to what Tanaka has done, essentially you're not really for the tantalum and the tungsten, we measured different crystalline forms in what he calculated. So it doesn't really mean anything. The numbers differ by an order of magnitude. Even for platinum, they're differing by over a factor of three. So. There's really no quantitative comparison to make yet, except the signs seem to work out. So, which is not nothing, but it's one bit of information. So I do also want to talk about the other component of current-induced torque. So the first experimental suggestion that there was a large effective field component of the torque was due to Moran et al. So these experiments where you measured the likelihood of sort of generating sort of stochastic domain reversal is a function of applying current and transverse magnetic fields. They originally inferred a very huge effective field from this sort of one Tesla fields at 10^8 anti-centimeter squared, which is 60 times the sort of spin Hall strength that we measure. But I think everybody agrees this interpretation isn't correct. Sort of these very large values have been contradicted by a number of measurements from different groups, including measurements by Gambardella sort of recently. So I think probably what's going on here is a manifestation of the spin Hall effect. It's essentially a damping times an anisotropic field versus an anisotropic field effect. And you can get, there's regimes of spin torque behavior where things would turn sideways. But this is not the thing to argue about. There is important discussion to go on about what are the current effective fields, but the ones people are talking about are much smaller than what Moran suggested originally. And my sort of experimental summary of the various measurements you've done so far, it seems to me if you have ferromagnetic layers thicker than 3 to 4 nanometers, all you see is the Oersted field. Whatever transfer field you have seems to agree quite well with the Oersted field. So I think these larger effective fields with Rothbach symmetry, really are something happening only for very thin layers. And you might argue that that's because you need the asymmetry, the work functions of the different sides that give you some field, so you only expect it for very thin planets. But I think probably the default explanation until there's really a convincing otherwise is you already expect a torque in this direction if you have a short dwell time and a thin film just from a spin Hall effect. And this is something that a number of groups have pointed out. It's a simple effect. It's actually, it was first pointed out, I think, back in the tunnel junction, just from spin filtering area by the Grandis group. The idea that if the spin going into the ferromagnet has a very short lifetime, or stays in the ferromagnet a very short time and then leaves, it can process just partway and then come back. And that gives a perpendicular kick, a perpendicular torque, where you wouldn't have the in-play torque. So my cartoon here is rather primitive, but I imagine you come in with a sort of a spin in the x direction, magnetization in the y direction, you polarize, you process around in the xz plane. And if you just process for a short time, you can think about, how much, what's the initial angular momentum, what's the final angular momentum, what the torque is. You average over an exponential distribution of time, so it's an average time short compared to the precession frequency. You've got in-plane and out-of-plane torques that run through the metal. So,
is that essentially imaginary part of mixing conduct?
Yes. Yeah, it's exactly. I mean,
looks like a step back, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, usually, if you're trying to calculate the mixing conductance, you assume a thick enough layer to average out all the spin polarization.
There's some leftover.
Yeah, and this is just the leftover bit, so it's exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, but I like this interpretation. It's a little easier to see because then you can see that okay, if it averages to zero, it's all absorbed by the ferromagnet versus if it's not.
Welcome. Back to the future. That's been all established.
If you say imaginary part of mixing conductance, what image does it apply to you? You just don't have a picture of what's happening.
Did you read the review, physics reports review article by
Anna? Did you review all my reviews?
It's
sold it, exactly. But I don't know if that's.
I mean, it's something that never.
I didn't keep it in my head, so that's not so good enough.
This is something that's never really explored in the traditional spin Hall samples, just because we tended to look at reasonably thick layers and didn't really care so much about anything but anti-damping torques. But it probably would be there too if we went back and looked at very thin layers.
Okay. One question: mm-hmm. Can you make any prediction about the size of the field light from this analysis?
I bet you can. I would not want to do it in front of you, but it should. I think it should have a definite sign.
Yeah, but I guess it is opposite to what has been measured.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's my guess. But
I mean, what's been measured is the platinum has an out-of-plane torque in the Oersted field direction, and the tantalum has an out-of-plane torque in the opposite direction. So it seems to vary with the spin Hall angle, but I'm not sure what it should be theoretically. I haven't worked that out myself.
Okay.
I mean, my signs and calculations are always 50-50, whether they're right or wrong. So that's what we need to risk for. Okay. So I'm an experimentalist. I don't have too much to say about mechanisms. I'll let you argue about that yourselves. But I think it's an interesting question whether or not there are experimental ways to distinguish the various mechanisms people suggested, whether it's a bulk spin Hall effect in the heavy metal versus some effective field going on within the ferromagnet, or whether there's interface effects that sort of combine the two or give separate effects of the sort that Hiro's been suggesting. So I think everyone agrees that if there is a short dwell time in the magnet, the two effects mix, so you can't distinguish them just based on symmetry. But I think there are things you can do, like sort of insert a spacer layer and see if there's any systematic ways that changes the two components. Doing more studies of the dependence of the thickness of the ferromagnet, asking questions like, do different ferromagnets give the same value of the parameters? And these data are coming. So hopefully that will resolve some of these issues and maybe provide some guidance about how to make the effects bigger or more robust in various kinds of ways. So I'm happy to have more discussions about that.
Well, you're not going to show any data on the slide?
So Bob showed a little bit about his material X during the conference.
And I don't know what the material is. So
I am not allowed to divulge, apparently. That's my instruction.
All right, sorry. So they'll talk about it.
So they'll try to get that written up. I think it looks to me that at least you have reasonable thicknesses of spacer layer, that the in-plane, out-of-plane things scale in the same way. But then for very thin thicknesses, something funny happens. And they start having differences, and we don't understand that yet. There might be materials issues with intermixing and stuff like that. But we're working on it.
How about this? Is there any data to this, or the last question?
Yeah, so in terms of platinum, we've studied cobalt, we've studied cobalt iron boron, we've studied permalloy. And within the experimental uncertainties, they all seem to give the same value. Both in plane and perpendicular plane.
Still doesn't necessarily mean anything,
but it's just so they know the mixing of vectors is similar, but they typically change the class from fermion to fermion.
But that's the point. But anybody has done Yu platform?
We're working on trying to do torque experiments there. I'll talk about that in a second, too. We've gotten so we can grow good materials now, but in terms of the fabrication stuff, we're still not quite to the final.
Is that any preliminary value?
No, we haven't. We're still trying to make devices that current actually flows through. It's hard to have really thin metals that go up a step, which is what you need here. We don't have continuity yet, but we'll figure that out. That's just important. Hopefully, the student is doing it at the top. I have faith in you. So. So I'll go quickly through some application stuff, because I do want to talk about some of the topological insulator stuff too. So you can do all kinds of neat manipulations with these current-induced torques. The first person to show this was true was Moran et al. So they have this beautiful experiment where they had a perpendicularly polarized cobalt layer and were able to switch it between up and down orientations by passing in-plane current with the neat symmetry that the switching was only reliable if you had a small component of magnetic field along the current direction or opposite to it, and the sign of that field depending on which way the switching was going. And Ronald argued that this was due to a torque within the ferromagnet. We argued that its origin was in the heavy metal, but you know that story, and that'll get set out. In terms of the symmetries of things, we agree about the symmetries of things, of the nature of the torque that's causing it. So it actually is sort of a neat effect. Interpreting it now within a spin Hall picture, what the spin Hall torque does is effectually give, depending on the sign of the current, an effective, an equivalent field that wants to rotate the moment clockwise or counterclockwise. And so with no in-plane magnetic field, there's no breaking of the symmetry. Things don't want to point up or down. They want to go clockwise or counterclockwise. What the in-plane field does within a simple macrospin cartoon, which I'll point out shortly here, is not actually the right microscopic picture, is just break the symmetry so that tilting is a little bit, so now the counterclockwise and clockwise have different symmetries. So with this tilting, then the counterclockwise torques would want to take you from down to up, and the clockwise from up to down, and that works out quite well in terms of how the symmetries work. So that was the original macrospin picture. We have been doing more experiments about these systems, trying to understand things like, well, what actually is the critical magnetic field you need to apply, and what sets that critical magnetic field and how it's going. And the key point here is that these macrospin cartoons really aren't accurate. These are large area samples. The reversal occurs by reversal of domain, sort of having reverse domains form, and then having domain walls propagate. And it appears that what's actually going on here is a story very similar to the domain wall picture within the wires. That what's really going on here is that when you start reversing samples, you form reverse domain. And whether or not you have switching or not depends on whether the current can expand or contract those domains. And if you have no magnetic field applied, it seems like the domain structure is the one governed by the DMI interaction, that within the domain wall, you can get all different directions forming. That means if you want to think about the effects of the current in terms of an equivalent field from the spin Hall torque, you don't get any spin Hall torque if you have the sort of moments point along the torque direction. And if you have moments point this way, you get effectively an up equivalent field. Over here, you get a equivalently down affected field. So that might shift the domain, but it won't cause it to expand or contract. So in order to have that expand or contract and then to shift the switching go, what the effective field does, what the applied field does, is it appears is to align the moment directions within the domain wall in one direction, and then the spin torque can act uniformly in this way to sort of have all the spins point up, and that would cause the domain to expand about that way. So it seems like the field scale is related to the DMI scale of these problems in much the same way as in the domain wall problem. But really, this is a much more accurate microscopic picture of what's going on compared to the other macroscopic.
The thing is, domains are coming from the edge, some edge.
There's thermal fluctuations or from edge effects, yeah. I mean,
it's probably not forming in center, it's probably coming from the edge, so you don't really know.
So these experiments are all done at high enough temperatures. It seems like the process is all thermally activated. So what we're assuming is that, right, we're assuming that it's a thermally activated process to form the domain, and then the current.
Like a circle. I wonder if you can really make it kind of quantitative to get all the critical field, the currents quantitatively. I wonder if that's really possible based on this picture.
Let's talk about that. We haven't tried to do more than just estimates so far. So we've been assuming circular shapes and stuff, but let's sit down and see. Okay, then the other geometry that's really interesting is the anti-damping switching. And so this works, just we've made devices that consist of small tunnel junctions on top of heavy metals. And this works, from all we can see in the experiments, exactly what you'd expect from the previous work on tunnel junctions and spin valves, that the critical currents work out quantitatively with what you expect based on the spin Hall angles. And it seems like this will be a very attractive way of making real memory devices that can scale down and work with very small currents. Whether you can also do it with very small energies is a problem, because so far the materials are working with a very high resistivity. It'd be nice to have a low resisting material with a big spin Hall angle, and that's one of the things I'll be asking about. Can we do that? But so far, that's kind of the state of the art of the challenge. We have done experiments to try to verify symmetries and things like that. You can see just from the switching phase diagram that it has sides and top and bottoms. If you just had an effective field kind of effect, you'd just expect to see sort of everything moving off, slipping. So this is sort of the classic signature of an anti-damping spin-torque transition, where you have field-like transitions or current-like transitions. So it all is just what you expect based on the old work on spin-transfer torque and multilayer. Just in terms of applications, this is also a nice thing in terms of reliability. For tunnel junctions, you always have to worry about, when you're doing switching, of not passing too much current to blow up your device. If you're trying to do things, make practical devices, you have a distribution of voltages you need to read, a distribution of voltages across the tunnel junctions you need for writing, and a distribution of breakdown of the tunnel junctions. And you need to have really good materials control, that you have big gaps between these two things, so you never blow up your junction when you're writing, and you never accidentally write something when you're trying to read, and things like that. So in terms of the magnetic industry, they spend a lot of time trying to make these distributions narrower and having 10 or 12 sigma spacing between certain things.
Why doesn't breakdown voltage look like that? I mean, if you have a very large voltage, you will break it down, right? Why does it go down?
Sorry.
My artistic abilities are being, the idea is, with these devices, you don't have to worry about the right distribution anymore. You don't ever have to put a large voltage across the tunnel variable switching. You pass current underneath, and it's sort of inherently reliable that way. It does come at a cost of having three terminals. That takes up more area. The industry says, oh, that, you know, maybe you don't want to do that, but there may be benefits of that too. So one other thing you can do with three-terminal devices is you can play other games. In addition to passing current underneath, you can apply voltages to your terminal junction at the same time. That allows you to do things like doing voltage-controlled magnetic anisotropy at the same time as doing spin Hall torque. And it seems like that will be a very nice kind of class of things to do. In terms of what that allows you to do is, say, vary this effective damping parameter for the in-plane switching, and that allows you to tune the current density by quite a bit. So we've demonstrated in the thermally activated regime, you can reduce the switching current by about a factor of 6. Here, the energy by a factor of 36. So there's games you can play combining different areas of research with these devices. There's also things you can do by combining these things. You might be able to make memories taking advantage of the three-terminal device structure, where you make an array of things like this, and are able to pick out one element array for switching by say, applying a voltage pulse across one column of devices, pass current under one row, and get switching just where those two effects act together and not switching anyplace else. So it's a selection mechanism that allows you to make memories without having to have a selection transistor for every bit, which is one of the things that industry likes. There's also schemes for doing readout this way that would be accurate. So that's certainly not demonstrated to the point where it's a valid technology, but it's an idea of an approach that might work in these sorts of cases. And then a couple other just examples before I move on to the top of filters. You can also, within these small devices, get current-induced oscillations and oscillator properties. If you have a confined device, you don't have to worry about the things Ilya was talking about in terms of all the nonlinear processes that this can happen in a bulk film. This works essentially what we expected based on this spin down devices for in case of door. With the extra added ingredient with the voltage-controlled magnetic anisotropy, you can have another knob to control the frequency. That works. You can control the VMAG, and then that allows you to control the frequency in that slide. So we can tune the frequency by about 40% or so. And I won't really say anything about the domain wall manipulation. You've seen lots of nice talks about this during the conference here, but that does all seem to work out fine. So what's happening in the future, and what are we working on now? Well, there's a couple of new things you can do with these devices that really we could never do before. One is to be able to manipulate spins inside insulators. But we no longer need to pass charge current through what we're manipulating in order to apply an efficient torque. And so we're certainly trying to do that. The practical goal there is maybe have lower damping materials, allow you to do switching at lower currents. So that we're certainly trying to see if we can get that to work with Gabe and various other related insulating ferromagnets. You can also do things with antiferromagnets because if you have some way of reading out the antiferromagnetic orientation, this should work. You should be able to dump spins into antiferromagnets just as well as a ferromagnet. So you can do things like trying to think if you can affect antiferromagnetic resonance in ways that. So we're beginning to work on these kinds of things. I'll show a little bit of data if I have time from what we're doing with antiferromagnets, but you know this is I think a lot of groups are trying to work on this. So before I move on and talk about the topological insulator work, I do just want to sort of try to get you thinking and try to get you to help me. What should I be writing in my NSF proposal? So in terms of practical applications, there's lots of parameters that you need to tune to make a good device. And it'd be nice to have some way of getting all these things to work well, and or at least understanding what the trade-offs are. We'd like to have a large spin Hall angle to get strong torques. We'd like to have a short spin diffusion length so we can use very thin layers so we can have as little current as possible. If for anti-damping switching, we need to have the spin pumping effect be weak. We'd like to have a large spin mix inductance in order to have clean transport of torque through materials. And we'd like to have low resistivities in the spin Hall metal in order to have the power consumption be as low as possible. And I don't know to what extent the small additional damping and the low resistivities are compatible with each other.
Are they all compatible with each other?
I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm asking you. Generally, if you get low resistivities, you get large spin mixing, large effective spin mixing conductances and lots of damping. But maybe, I don't know, maybe there's ways around that. We don't really know much about the mechanisms, whether they're bulk or surface, whether they're intrinsic or extrinsic. In terms of searching for new materials, we sort of need guidance on where to look. We don't know to what extent these different consequences of spin orbital coupling material are coupled together, or whether they can be tuned independently. We don't know how much surface versus bulk effects are important. We don't know things like proximity-induced magnetic moments, to what extent they matter. You know, I think there's pretty convincing evidence there are proximity-induced moments in platinum and palladium. I don't know about tantalum and tungsten, whether things would be similar there. They don't have the same sort of bulk susceptibilities, but who knows what goes on at these interfaces. And then another question I have is just, are there differences between spin torque at insulating interfaces versus metallic interfaces, or is everything just the spin mixing conductance?
Definitely not spin mixing conductance.
Okay.
Why not? That's a quantity.
Yeah. That is, that's the difference between the tetric and the insulating. That's the same thing.
That's, but that's,
yeah, that means there's no difference in your perspective, just metallic and insulating. Is there a difference between metallic ferromagnets and insulating?
And there's all that one parameter described above.
I'm happy to have conversations with you. Okay. So unless there's other questions or points of discussion, I'll go on and talk about sort of what we're trying to do, similar sorts of experiments on topological insulators. What motivated these experiments, and I'm not saying this is actually what the experiments are showing, but what motivated us to look at these things was a different mechanism for how you might get a current-induced torque. The idea that because you have spin momentum locking on the surface of a topological insulator, if you start to flow in-plane current, you do something like shift the Fermi surface, that would cause you to have extra spin-up electrons, fewer spin-down electrons, and so that would give you a non-equilibrium spin accumulation at the surface. That's just the sort of the simplest trivial consequence of the spin momentum locking. And the question was, if you in some way couple this to an adjacent ferromagnet, could that angular momentum that's on the surface flow to the ferromagnet and apply some sort of spin field?
Well, you call the now you call it the Emmelstein effect, which is what I would have called it, versus the Radman effect, which is the exact same thing. For the feedback or the exact same process.
Yeah, so I don't know the history of all these things. Much of it happened before I was born, so I'm happy to educate them.
No, this is
getting old.
It happened after you were born.
Okay. Okay, but yeah, so this I mean,
it's the same process.
It's the same process. Yeah, so if you have a Rochebach surface state, you'd have exactly
the same inverse galvanic effect in 3D or in 2D.
Yeah, so I think the physics is the same. So I guess one point I'll come back to is that with the shift, you don't have any spin current flowing in equilibrium. Sort of if you replace spin down electrons moving backward with spin up electrons moving forward, it's equivalent in terms of spin flow. But you would expect a non-equilibrium spin accumulation from this. And I'll come back because we're also thinking about trying to do gating experiments where we actually have in-plane spin flows. But I'll come back to that in a few minutes. So this motivates, can you see, are there strong current-induced torques in topological insulators? We can measure them experimentally using similar techniques, and you know, we're just looking, is there a big effect or not? So how do you want to do this experiment? Well, there's a right way to do this experiment, which we're not doing yet. The right way to do the experiment is to put on some sort of insulating ferromagnet on top of the topological insulator and see if you can manipulate the moment of the insulating. The problem with using a metal is topological insulators, they're not insulating, but they're not very good conductors. And for us, we'll do experiments where we put just permalloy on top of here first. The difference in the resistivities is about a factor of 30. So most of the current then flows through your ferromagnet. You have a very small amount of current to try to generate any torque.
The resistivity or resistances?
The resistivities are a factor of 30. We often use the same thickness as the materials, but it's the resistivities that are a factor of 30.
But you don't really know the distribution of currents for the topological insulator, do you?
No, and we don't know that what the effective resistivity is once we put the metal on top of there, because it might shift bands and do all kinds of awful things. So we can measure, what we do is we take topological insulator, put aluminum oxide down on top, we can measure the resistance there, we can do the same process, put metal and then cap aluminum oxide. If we measure the resistance there, we measure the resistance of the metal. So we don't know so that's the biggest uncertainty experiments and why you really want to do this experiment rather than what we do. But we don't know how to get the materials right for this yet, so it's a quick and dirty experiment. We'll try the metal and see if we see anything. You know, our attitude was, well, you know, only a few percent, it'd be a miracle if we see something. If we see something, that it's a good motivation for us to really work hard on insulating.
So other people also try to dope topological insulators and magnetic state. Have you pursued that line?
So we're just starting that. So Nitin can grow nice calcium dope bismuth selenide and bismuth telluride now, I guess. So that we think should work.
Is it chromium?
Is it chromium? Okay.
Yeah. So what are the amber checks about
selenide? That's fine, Chris. Yeah. So that's the experiment we're trying in the next few months. So. As soon as we get the growth on that, we can try that. Okay, so this is what we've actually done. So it's about 8 nanometers or 16 nanometers of bismuth selenide with about 8 nanometers of permalloy on top. So pretty thick layers. You have to use pretty thick layers because the growth is not perfect here. They're not very smooth films. There's considerable roughness on the few nanometer scale, and that might be a complication here. As I said, the resistivities differ by about a factor of 30. But if you do the experiment, You see very nice resonances in the fMR experiment. You can decompose that into the symmetric and asymmetric terms like we've done before, and from the symmetric term work out what the effective torque in plane is. And also from the asymmetric point, you can work out what the effective torque in the Oersted-like symmetry is like as well.
How thick is the protocol exactly?
We usually use about 8 nanometers.
8 nanometers, so pretty thick.
Pretty thick, yeah. And we can do one other measurement to check things. We can look at the current dependence and the damping in the same samples and see if that agrees. And right now it agrees. So you get the same in-plane torque to the symmetry of the spin hall from both kinds of measurements there. And if you just assume that the current flowing within the bismuth selenide is what you'd expect from the measured resistivities, which may not be right at all, this is what you get for the effective spin hall angle, just the torque in the in-plane direction versus the torque in the Oersted field-like direction.
But it's normalized for this resistivity, right?
Normalized resistivity.
So the actual effect is very small, in a way.
So
the multiplied by 30.
So the total amount of torque is small. It's big enough to measure, but so total torque is small, but if you, the run of current is really, really small, so that means you have a big spin hall. That's the argument. So it's, you know, the effective spin hall ratio, or the effective ratio of the spin torque ratio, maybe we should call it, is a factor of 10 bigger than what we've seen for other materials. You might ask if, you know, are you off on the current by a factor of 10? And the honest answer is we don't really know. But even if we're off by a factor of 10, you'd be seeing a very strong effect. There's also a torque with the Oersted field symmetry that seems to be much bigger than what we'd expect from the Oersted component as well. So we've been working a little bit with Una Kim's group. Within a rather crude model, they were able to show it's reasonable to get torques in both directions. I don't know how much weight to put on that theory particularly, but it seems like we're getting, experimentally it looks like, we're getting big torques with both
torques. So the torques are the same, pretty much.
Pretty much basically. The same. And things scale pretty much like you expect with changing the thickness of layers, but I don't think that tells you a whole lot.
Would you please comment on the contribution from the kind of pivot distance between the polyvalent and the PI on this result?
So I can tell you what the analysis is, and we try to keep the analysis as simple as possible, and there may be ways in which it's wrong. So I don't want to try to put anything over on you. But what we did was we just tried to measure what the resistivity of the bismuth selenide was with no metal layer on top. Then we put the metal layer on top, assume that the resistivity of the bismuth selenide doesn't change, and calculate, you know, what fraction of current flows in the bismuth selenide there. So we don't try to calculate whatever sort of gradients in the current density there might be within the layer. I think with a simple bilayer, you wouldn't expect, I'll think about that. But we did the most simple-minded thing that we could there.
And what exactly is the measure? Just curious, just this kind of double frequency technique?
Just the resistivity?
Would you measure, how do you extract the spin angle? You measure
This is the here the signals are small, so you really need the STFMR. You need the on resonance measurement.
On the resonance measurement, but still you measure it's kind of the effect is proportional to power.
Yes, we have checked that.
You measuring also the transverse voltage or something.
You can.
This one. Okay.
And we have.
But this is the AMR, right?
This is the AMR effect.
You're measuring the AMR. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've tried to measure spin pumping by looking at the longitudinal effect and the transverse effect and changing angles, and it looks like now that the spin pumping effect isn't really big in the system. But that's one of the things that we want to check before we actually send this in for review.
So AMR,
it's
affected also by this bismuth selenide, of course.
Oh,
it's a thing.
So we measure the AMR with the bismuth selenide there. So you can just measure how the resistance changes the whole structure as you change the angle.
But so you just calibrate it's that. Very similar to bulk.
It seems to depend a little bit on how rough the substrate is.
So the substrate does affect your AMR.
Yes. So we see different AMR when we put the we see difference between just bare silicon versus bismuth selenide. We also see it if we try to do things to roughen a certain substrate and they're just put down without the bismuth selenide. There it changes somewhat.
So it's just rough because then it may not have anything to do with spin-hall interactions in the.
I wouldn't want to make any.
But it could just be something one day.
It could be Monday, yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think I wouldn't make too much of this. I think all, the conclusion is that we should get our act together and do the right experiment, but this gives us some hope that maybe some, we see something.
But if you estimate you know, anything like switching, it's kind of out of the question.
So, well, I mean, for switching a metal, yeah, it's out of the question. But if you had an insulating ferromagnet with somewhat lower damping and you weren't shutting all the current through the ferromagnet, the numbers would be reasonable for switching. Yeah. So that's one of the things we'd like to do if we can figure out a way to do that. That's a harder experiment.
So if this was an insulator, then you think you could actually switch it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think. So if we even with the damping, even with the spin pumping and contribution of damping, I think if we weren't shunting all the current through the magnet, we'd have enough torque to do switching. Okay, so I'm going to toward the end. I wanted to sort of give one question to you. Think about a different kind of spin torque experiment to do on a topological layer. Is there a way to set something up so we can do a spin torque with the in-plane current in a topological insulator? And there's a sort of, I think this won't work, but I can't figure out the reason why not. And let me explain. So if you want to form a spin current within a topological insulator, you can't just apply a voltage and have charge current flow, as I explained. But you can, just by gating, change the chemical potential for electrons, say from with a gradient from one spot to another. And if you think about sort of what's going on here, you have lots of spin down electrons that's in here, fewer spin up electrons, and so you do have a spin dependent current flowing in between these two regions. So the idea, and actually Charlie Kane suggested this to me, is to make a device like this, which you know contains some permoi wire to absorb spin current, act like a spin current detector, put it between two gates, do experiments where you just change the chemical potential of electrons and see if that will apply a spin torque on the top on the permoi that you can measure from the reorientation of the permoi. And in a simple-minded approach, you know, thinking about the usual kind of spin currents, you can say, well, I'd expect these sort of spin currents to be absorbed by the permoi and give some sort of anti-damping torque, and maybe just be able to do a DC measurement where I put constant voltages, measure the FMR line width, how that varies with the voltage, and gets out some measurement of the strength of the in-plane spin current. But I don't think that should work just from energy conservation. That if these are equilibrium spin currents, not non-equilibrium spin currents, how can they give anti-damping from an equilibrium spin? That won't work. So I don't know where in the microscopic picture things go wrong. Howard?
I'm a bit confused. You went somewhat really fast.
Okay.
Can you explain it again?
So the idea is to try to make an in-plane spin current just by putting different gate voltages on different areas of the sample with a small gap between them. Mm-hmm. So you just change the chemical potential. So you have, say, spin current with spins pointed vertically here flowing along. And then why couldn't I just put a permoi sample here absorbing the transverse component of the incoming spin to some way?
It's just an equilibrium. The gradient of chemical potential induces equilibrium. But that's completely useless.
That's what I'm asking. It seems, this is the question I want to understand. Why can't a magnet absorb?
Well, it's an equilibrium. So of course it will introduce a little bit of some kind of contribution to the free energy of the ferromagnet.
Yeah, so it certainly
changes. Because now it's an additional symmetry that's broken.
Yeah, it certainly could change the anisotropies and stuff. That
in a way, which is different from Rajbon, but it's not. I don't think that's going to give anything that interesting. Mm.
But why won't it absorb? Why won't there be a net flow of equilibrium current into the ferromagnet?
Well, there is. There is.
Just like architectural itself to do the counterflow.
It's again like a surface state. The electrons are scattered into this wire again.
Mm-hmm. It's an equilibrium, so it's like arctic wire interactions or whatever. Right? So that's what gives rise. That's a microscopic mechanism behind some additional anisotropy that corresponds to the symmetry.
But you can
have
voltage control
anisotropy,
maybe.
Yeah, so I think that
you can have maybe voltage control anisotropy.
It's like an equilibrium.
Like the non-local exchange coupling.
Yeah, so I understand that can happen. But why? What goes wrong in the simple picture so that anti-damping doesn't work? I agree, there must something go wrong.
It's not equilibrium, in fact.
Right, that's what I understand. But if you're thinking microscopically about spins moving along, what happens?
No point. I mean, it's just not how it works. This is just an elastic twist. Yeah, it's part of the free energy.
But if, is there some process by which there's a backflow set up that I don't see in my pictures here? That
just
yeah, I have to like, you know, okay, some kind of backflow, some kind of balancing. I mean, it's you can pose it as some kind of puzzle, you know, for students to figure out. But the result is, we'll know what the result
is. Yeah, I agree with that completely. I just don't know how to solve the puzzle myself. Well, I think it's interesting to see what kind of, just changing the isotropy would also be something we could measure. It's the it's the other component of the torque.
Well, isotropy will be the fact that's one, But that's, again, it's just driven by the symmetry, right? You kind of apply a gradient now in this direction, right? So in interface is like a gradient in this direction. Now you kind of engineering gradient in this direction. Mm-hmm. You have some X of torques, but that's really not a game changer somehow, in a way.
I mean, I think it would be a cute thing to see if we could figure out a way to do, but and I think it still might be useful because we can measure the changes in anisotropy just as well as we can measure anything else, but anyway, I admit that something must go wrong with it, but I still don't see what's happening to the spins, that why an absorption of a transverse component of spins doesn't give an anti-damping.
Well, you can think about this. It's like article Y. You can pose this question, and why don't you have Slonczewski type of torque in a spin model by the same line of argument? You know, take two for a magnet, tilt one, the electrons are kind of drifting, and there's a Slonczewski torque already in equilibrium.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Why don't you have it? I mean, it's just you have to very carefully balance things, right?
Yeah.
For the kind of backflows and all this balancing. But it's nothing special about Poisson's weight in this sense.
Okay. Well, anyway. So I've run out the end of time. I think I'll probably just set up conclusions and take questions here. But I'm happy to talk about the other two. These are just projects that are just beginning to go in our group in terms of working with antiferromagnets and putting graphene as the tunnel barrier junctions that we're starting to see some effects we don't fully understand. And I'm happy to talk about those individually.
Can you show the graphene slide? That's my question.
Yeah, can you walk us through your... whatever you do with antiferromagnets, I think.
Okay, so we've been trying to repeat your experiments with the goal of then moving on and trying to do things like spin torque and antiferromagnets. Just want to give credit these beautiful results where you see, you know, huge changes in the magnetic resistance of a tunnel junction with iridium manganese on one side of the MVO. So this struck us as, you know, oh my God, kind of thing. And very, very impressive. And so we'll see if, you know, we like huge effects. We'll see if we can use this and see what we can do. So we have reproduced what you've done, so no argument there. We don't have, our best devices aren't quite as large as the largest magnetic resistance you've seen, but, you know, we see, so changes from 0.6 to 0.95, so, you know, many tens of percent changes in magnetic resistance through very similar structures with, this is what this consists of, is an iridium manganese electrode exchange bias to permalloy, and you, the idea is you rotate the permalloy, you have an exchange spring effect in the interferometer that rotates partially the moments of the interferometer, and maybe that changes the resistance of the tunnel.
What is the thickness of your
iridium? It's the same as what you did here. So we've tried to do other things, but this one is the same. And these are, you know, big devices still, so 9 by 3 microns. But the thing that's puzzling us right now is, I think there's something that you've seen, is the statistics of the effect are somewhat unusual. That you see a huge effect, but you don't see it very often. Maybe fewer than 10% of the devices that we measure show this sort of nice effect. Most typically what you see is basically nothing. And sometimes you see all kinds of strange things where, you know, the thing is switching all over in all kinds of ways what you wouldn't expect just from sort of a simple exchange spring effect. So we're still trying to figure out what's going on here. I have questions, so I knew you'd be here, and I was hoping you'd answer them too. But this isn't what the kind of statistics we expect from having an effect that's sort of uniform over a broad area tunnel junction with sort of nice, sort of some sort of average exchange bias between the ferromagnet and the tunnel barrier. It's something you see in a small fraction of devices, but there's huge effects. And there's not all that many cases in experimental physics where you see huge effects, but they're this hard to reproduce, or the statistics are sort of this way. So I don't know what's going on, but I'm wondering whether maybe we're looking not at a process that's a broad area of the whole device. Maybe there's some weak spots in the tone embrace. You're sensitive to local areas rather than the whole broad areas. Maybe there are effects of strain that are hard to reproduce between devices to devices. I'm not sure why things are so strongly temperature dependent, but I just want to let you know that, you know, we're able to reproduce what we have, but we don't fully understand it yet. And I don't know if you have any more comments or anything you can do to help us get things more reproducible, or whether you have different experiences.
Well, we can discuss it in detail, but I think the biggest problem is the exchange spring, which, you know, that's why we lose the effect at high temperatures, because we basically lose the exchange spring effect there. There is an experiment where they, it's not our group, where they replaced the permaloid with a cobalt platinum, which is a perpendicular material. The exchange coupling is known to be much stronger. And there, they have very reproducible exchange spring, and it survives up to room temperature. It's virtually temperature independent.
Okay.
I think most of the problems are with the exchange spring, because we, even when we lose the exchange spring, we still see the stochastic effect of the size of the TAMR.
Okay.
We cannot really control it, it's not in a controllable way. The antiferromagnet is switching between the two states, and you see the effect. So, but once you have a solid exchange spring, then everything is reproducible, and we have the reproducible over many devices in many different configurations.
Okay.
So I think it's just the coupling.
Okay, so if we try cobalt iron boron, you think we could do that? Okay, we can do that.
The material seems to work out. You know, this was the DRL from 2012 by this Chinese group.
Is that the one with the really small effects? It's
a relatively small effect because they have an analog barrier, and I think that's the problem. We have MGO, you guys have also.
Yeah, we were wondering just about AMR effects from the electrodes. The effect was so small there, too. But but we can definitely try that as well. So you want to see the graphene really quickly, yes? So I guess the motivation here is some predictions that if you have multi-layer graphene, or even single-layer graphene as a tunnel barrier, you do get spin filtering because of the way the densities of states match up between the ferromagnets and the graphene. Even for a single layer, you should expect maybe 25% magnetic resistance. And they have the pessimistic definition of magnetic resistance here. So for thicker layers, they expect essentially 100% spin polarization was the prediction.
And
So they did that, yeah. So the experiments have been done so far. There's actually the original group that did the original graphene work did the first tunnel the Gein group. And Yonker has also published last year an experiment. But in both of those experiments, they actually made a magnetic electrode, exposed it to air, and actually Yonker's group dunked it in water in the process of putting the graphene on top, and then measured tunneling on top. So so the resistance area products there were huge, you know, 35,000 to 100,000, compared to if you have a 1.5 nanometers MGO, you have 10 to 100 micron squared. So we think there's lots of oxide at their ferromagnet. They're not really measuring the intrinsic properties of the graphene. So we try to develop a process where we make a suspended graphene layer and then just deposit metal on one side or the other and have no oxidation of electrodes and see what we see there. And it's not quite that simple in terms of what we do, because if you just make graphene by itself and deposit metal on one side, so far the graphene's been breaking. So what we do is have graphene with PMMA on top, which kind of holds things together, evaporate metal on one side, take the device out, get rid of the PMMA, so there is some air exposure of the graphene on one side, but it seems from the experiments we've done, if you have pristine graphene without grain boundaries or holes, it's a good oxidation barrier and the electrode doesn't get oxidized on the side, and then we put it back in the vacuum chamber and evaporate the second electrode. So you have a device like this. What we find if we make small enough devices that are sort of able to generally get within one grain, we see resistance area products down at 1.5 to 6 micron squared, so 10,000 times less than what's been done previously. So I think not having an oxidized electrode does help. If you do just simple Simmons-Brinkman model fits just to get qualitative ideas of the barrier height and things like that, it's a low barrier height and a thin width, so not crazy numbers from a Simmons-Brinkman fit. But so far, the magnetic resistance is still not very high. So at low temperatures, you know, 1.5 to 3.5%, so not 25%.
You would expect the transport to be dominated in pinhole, because
just a single atomic layer.
So we can look at the voltage dependence and the temperature dependence, and it looks like tunneling more than metallic pinholes. So I'm not sure.
Strange somehow.
What?
So if you really think it's a single layer, atomic layer, within, isn't it strange that it acts as a tunnel layer without any pinholes? I mean,
well, you can make graphene. I mean, we do CVD graphene, so it's not pristine epitaxial graphene. But
what's the area? How much do you need it to be like perfect?
So our domain size is on the order of a micron, and we're trying to make 250 nanometer spots to go down. So sometimes we'll have a domain wall there, sometimes we don't. We do see variations. It looks to me like when we have a grain boundary or some other impurity that oxygen does get through and oxidize our electrodes, so we end up with higher resistances rather than lower resistances. And in some fraction of our devices, we see high resistances, and they tend, when we make devices bigger, we see a bigger fraction of devices with higher resistances. So I think that's just air getting through. But we do see in about half of our smallest devices sort of low RA products in this range.
So. I wonder if it's just like graphene together with some kind of junk, you know? Because otherwise, if it's really perfect, right? Even like a single atom missing or some kind of dislocation would probably kill you, right?
So, yeah, so.
If it's kind of dressed up, kind of functionalized as junk, mm-hmm. in a way, right? Then it would be more. But
yeah, so the question is, you know, are there any defects in the graphene? And in good CVD graphene, you should go over pretty large areas without...
But once it's rolling, the metals on both sides, it's not that intrusive. I'm just kind of...
I don't know. I mean, this is what results we have. One thing we're hoping to do is be able to actually image the graphene before we put the metal down. Uh-huh. With the kind of STEM we have at Cornell, we can do that. So we can see if there's a grain boundary there or other things. We haven't done those experiments yet just because of practical aspects of how do we make a lot of devices and scan all of them and things like that, because the sample holders inside the STM are kind of clumsy for fabricated devices. But I think all those kinds of things are possible looking to the future. I think looking at multilayer graphene is also possible. You can grow CVD graphene on nickel, for instance, and grow various kinds of numbers of multilayers. So we should be able to do that. I don't think we'll be able to make epitaxially matched metal on the graphene, and maybe that's important. I don't really know, but you know, I think it's sort of an interesting thing to try because it would be interesting to get very low RA, you know, perfect single atomic layer tunnel barriers with high magnetic resistance. So I think it's worth trying a little bit. One other thing we've seen in small devices, it looks like there's a fairly strong antiferromagnetic coupling across the graphene. It goes away if things are oxidized. So I don't
What's
think
the
it's
question a. I have? What is the, this is just one graphene layer.
One graphene layer.
What's the distance between the magnets left and right?
So
it looks like you. It's so thin that you should have arced the y direction, no?
It's a question about what actually kind of coupling you have through graphene. I don't know the answer to that, but this could be dipole coupling, but I don't think so, just because it seems to, if the samples go bad with oxidation, it goes away. So I wouldn't expect the dipole coupling to do that. So it looks to me like an interface effect, and it looks pretty strong. So I just wanted to see if there was interest among you guys along that line as well. But I don't, from a theoretical point of view, I don't know what to expect about that.
Exchange.
No, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the distance would be really important between the magnetic layers,
And that's something we could look at one or two or three layers, perhaps. It's really strong. I mean, it's a good fraction of 1,000 Oersteds if you think about what you need to actually decouple those things. Yeah, sure. That's sort of what's going on currently. And I'd be happy to take any other questions or suggestions or particularly good materials to try.
And the speaker. For TI case, you mentioned in your review graph that you don't have any way to distinguish default versus space effect. I just wonder if you can vary the, for instance, the thickness of TI and the thickness of the ferromagnet to distinguish these two.
So we've done that. We can talk about this more later, but I don't see how changing the thickness of the TI would give you insight about bulk versus surface so much yet. It seems like in either case, both effects seem to me like they would scale the same way with thickness.
well, if it's very, very thin PI, then
sure.
The problem could have to interface with the right. Different surfaces.
It's difficult to make really, really thin TIs where you don't have all kinds of terrible things happening when the ferrum mesh doesn't
happen. The eye is problem.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, in terms of experiments, they're not particularly insulating to start with, so.
What's the problem with the eye?
But maybe with spin stuff, that's not so important. But another thing we can do is look at different materials where there's less bulk conduction. And so that's one of the things we're working on with Nitin. He's had, his group has learned how to do the doping to get the conduction down recently, and we haven't processed those samples all the way through to measurements yet.
I think we're out of time, but Dan is going to be around until end of the week, right?
Right.
Yeah. So
Friday or
Saturday morning.
Yeah. Okay. That's-